I'm David Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a deadly war, political deadlock characterizes Washington as well as Baghdad. Back in May, after both the U.S. House and Senate passed legislation to set a withdrawal date, the president killed the bills with a veto, and lawmakers don't have the votes to override the president. So what is Congress going to do next to end a war that's increasingly unpopular? In the House, anti-war Democrat John Murtha of Pennsylvania is floating a compromise idea. Force the president to begin troop withdrawals within 60 days, but set no deadline beyond that. For the latest on that proposal and other ideas to change direction in Iraq, we turn to Adam Graham Silverman, who writes for Congressional Quarterly. Adam, tell us more about Congressman Murtha's proposal. Which troops would he withdraw first?
Well, as you said, it does not set any kind of conditions on the end or the form that this withdrawal would take. So it's not clear who would go first, but it does call for a complete withdrawal, meaning all troops and all American paid contractors would be getting out of Iraq. Murtha said he thought it would take about a year to do the whole thing, but it does go a little bit farther than plans that have suggested we keep people in the country for counterterrorism or to train Iraqi forces.
So what's different between this proposal and the bill the House already passed that set a clear timetable?
Well, it does not have an end date, which is a sticking point for a lot of people who are uncomfortable with what might happen in the next couple months in Iraq and who don't want to tie the military's hands. So that may earn it some more support, but the fact that it calls for a complete withdrawal may cost it support as well.
So how much of a chance does this stand?
Well, that may be more of a political question because this will come up as an amendment to the defense spending bill for the next fiscal year, and that's a bill that Mr. Murtha has said he wants to see enacted no matter what by October 1st, the start of the fiscal year. So it's not clear how much support it will have, but even if it does get adopted to this bill, it might be something that he would have to jettison in order to get the spending bill enacted. But separately, in September, Congress is going to take up a supplemental spending bill of about $140 billion for the war, and that bill, Murtha has said, he could hold that funding up depending on the progress reported in the September 15th report from U.S. commanders in Iraq.
So, Adam, it seems like we still have this muddle in Washington. You know, we keep on hearing senators, congressmen, they want a change in the policy. So far, they've been unable to force any change at all. So, you know, you have 60% of Americans saying the war isn't worth fighting. You know, the new benchmark for American troops killed is going to be 4,000. Why is it so hard to pass Iraq legislation in Congress?
The partisan margins in Congress are much narrower and represent much farther ends of the ideological spectrum than the American people do. So you have a very narrow margin in the Senate in which something without huge bipartisan support can't get through.
And yet aren't all of them feeling some heat from this polling data?
Well, those who are, there have been some votes that have given them political cover, and those who are, a lot of them are really sticking to their guns, keeping their powder dry, saying they're going to wait just a little longer to pass any judgment and break from the president.
Well, Murtha says it's all going to come to a head in September. Is it really going to come to a head in September? That's, of course, when General Petraeus's report is due out. People keep on referring to that now. Is that going to bring this to a head?
I think it will, because from the positioning we're seeing, it already looks like they're not expecting to hear good things in that report, and many of the Republicans who have said wait till September are going to have to break with the president at that point.
The Senate is controlled by Democrats by a far narrower margin than they control the House. Is the Senate the real problem here?
It is. It is indeed. As I said, it takes 60 votes to move anything through the Senate. So, and that's a very high bar. Republicans have stuck with Bush so far.
Adam Graham Silverman reports for the Congressional Quarterly. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Thank you.
We turn now to Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska. He's considered the leading conservative Democrat in the U.S. Senate at a time when Democrats are being criticized for not doing enough to end the war, and Republicans must decide whether to back or break away from an increasingly unpopular war. Nelson says he wants to change the war effort, but so far he's voted against almost every measure trying to force the president to change policy. In that sense, Nelson emblemizes both the middle and the muddle in Washington. He sits on two committees with great power to influence war policy, the Armed Services Committee and the Appropriations Committee. Senator Nelson joins us on the line from Washington. Welcome, Senator.
Well, thank you, David. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. The number of congressmen calling for no change in Iraq seems remarkably small, but so far Congress has not forced any change in direction in Iraq. How do you explain that?
Well, I think that it's been a very difficult thing for some people to break with the White House. The White House, I think, has urged no action until the September 15th report by General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker. And some have gone along with the White House. However, Senator Susan Collins and I have introduced an amendment that would help transition our forces away from fighting that civil war in Baghdad and instead focus our resources on going after al-Qaeda in Iraq, transitioning and a residual force to protect border integrity, training Iraqi security forces, guarding U.S. assets, and helping secure the country internally. I think is important. And there are people, there are some of the members who are beginning to look at this proposal as something that, in mid-September, when we get that report, that could possibly be the kind of result that everybody's looking for. It's not a withdrawal with a date. It is an immediate retransitioning, if you will, our troops away from fighting the civil war to going after al-Qaeda.
But is it feasible to expect that American troops can pick out al-Qaeda from other soldiers, other combatants in Iraq?
Well, you wouldn't do just the al-Qaeda. You would go after all the bad guys. And the intelligence information now that is human intelligence, as it's called, is increasingly improved. And what we have to do is change the idea that we can win their civil war for them. What we have to do is recognize that there is no way to win another country's civil war, and they can't do it militarily. They've got to do it politically. Mm-hmm. But in that sense, pulling our troops away from fighting that civil war gives us the capacity to go after the bad guys wherever they are.
And yet, it's said if there are no timetables to withdraw, then the danger is that those who want change, and you say you're one of them, are all slow walking here, and there's nothing ever going to be binding and no way to bring this war to an end.
Well, I'm not sure that's the case. You know, if you've set up benchmarks and we can measure and will have measured for us whether there's any kind of commitment, whether there's any kind of effort, or are there any results, if there is no commitment, I'm not sure at what level you continue the battle for that Iraqi government.
You know, Senator, I'm sure you're keenly aware, it's been observed that Congress is way out of sync with the voters on the war. An ABC News Washington Post poll this week found 60% of American surveys say the war in Iraq is not worth fighting. Closer to home for you, back in Nebraska, a poll taken in April conducted by the state Democratic Party showed 51% of Nebraskans thought the surge was wrong, and only 54% of Republicans sided with the president.
And I oppose that surge going into Baghdad.
But you're a popular senator in Nebraska. That's clear, Senator. But was this war a mistake in the beginning?
Well, you know, you can always look and decide what should or shouldn't have been done. There's no question but what a number of very critical mistakes were made in terms of the conduct of the war.
So your point now, I summarize, is that the war can be won against al-Qaeda of Mesopotamia.
Yes.
It can't be won if we're fighting militias and engaging in what you call as a civil war.
That's correct. And I don't think it's our responsibility to do it. I think it's wrong to do it. And I think that that's what the Iraqi government has to do. And if we don't insist that they do it, then this cycle of dependence is likely to continue.
But the war continues. And, of course, we have the story in the New York Times this week that they're now, that the administration, the plan is now taking it to 2009 anyway, well into 2009. The war continues. There are no changes yet. Now, it's clear that the liberal Democrats in the Senate haven't been able to bring about a change. They're somewhat hostile to some of your ideas, but your position here is that you and Republicans who have split off from their party but don't want to fully side with liberal Democrats
right.
will be able to bring about the only change that might be brought about in that war policy, yes?
That may be a good summary of it. I hope it works that way because the requirement for troops would be significantly lower. Bringing people home, we have to make changes on what was really has turned out to be one of the longest wars in history, certainly in modern history, and that we've been engaged in, and we have to figure out a way to I think do it.
Senator Nelson, last question. People are looking, of course, at Senator Warner, John Warner, the Republican important person here. Senators Lugar, Snow, Collins. People that have broken, all Republicans who were, Domenici is another one, criticized the administration, still voting largely with them on many of the main points here. You think that come September that those people, those senators, are going to agree with you on this course?
I think there's no doubt that this is the type of course that will emerge in September. It is in fact, I think, being the groundwork is being laid with the president's speech positioning, I think, himself to deal with Al-Qaeda. It's something that I think people can understand and agree with, and in the process of doing it, you'll see significant reductions in our troops there, and people will feel that they're being listened to. You know, the July report was a forecast. I think I can tell you with every thought of being accurate when I say come September there will be a change. Mm.
Senator, how many men and women from Nebraska? Or coming from Nebraska, have you lost in this war now?
We have lost nearly 60 soldiers from Nebraska, and I have two calls to make for two fallen soldiers and their families in Nebraska. I've made these calls because I think it's the right thing to do, but I want the people, the loved ones, to know that their lost soldiers' commitment has not gone unnoticed or unappreciated. I think they need to hear that from somebody who has supported the war, not necessarily the conduct of it, but has supported the war.
A difficult war in Nebraska and in Washington.
Yes, it is.
Democrat Ben Nelson, junior senator from Nebraska. Thanks for joining us, Senator.
Thank you, David.
Just ahead, the Taliban executes a South Korean hostage who was in Afghanistan with a group of Christian missionaries. We look at the explosion of Korean missionaries who are venturing out into some unfriendly territory in Asia and in the Middle East. And later in the show, soccer and war meet up in Iraq, here and now. I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now. 22 members of a South Korean Christian church are still being held hostage in Afghanistan. The Taliban have already killed one man. The church says the Koreans were not involved in any missionary work, but Afghanistan and other Muslim countries have long been destinations for South Korean Christians eager to spread their faith. And to help us understand where that faith comes from, we're joined by Moon Jang Lee, Associate Professor of World Christianity at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in Massachusetts. Professor Lee, tell us how Christianity got a foothold in Korea.
Christianity was delivered to Korea not by colonialists, the imperialists. It was Japan who occupied the Korean peninsula. So the gospel came with Americans and Australians and British. They were the good side. And Korean church feel that it's time, it's their turn to bring the gospel to the nations. remembering the sacrifice and service given to them by the Western missionaries and Christian workers.
Professor Lee, it's a very difficult issue and a sensitive issue, but is there the sense that these people that were there should never have been there because they lacked training, they lacked proper guidance from the leaders that brought them there?
I guess they might have received guidance and training, but the context was too dangerous. They could have avoided that journey. They were warned by the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Korean government to avoid this territory, but they ignored that, and that was their mistake, I guess.
And there were plenty of warnings. Last year, the government of Afghanistan deported 1,200 South Koreans who'd flown to Kabul for a peace parade, and the Taliban had threatened to kill missionaries who secretly entered the country.
Right, right. We constantly criticize among the mission scholars in Korea, from within the Korean circles, about this triumphalistic attitude of the Korean church. And it's time for, that's what we say, we ought to be awakened to a new reality in the global context. But the Korean church has been slow in perceiving that we are living in a very different environment from our brothers and sisters from the West.
As you know, 2004, South Korean missionary was beheaded in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Let me read you a quote about the man who was beheaded.
Mm-hmm.
He is a martyr to God's glory. Korean missionaries are eager to do God's work and glorify God.
Mm-hmm.
They want to die for God.
Mm-hmm.
That came from Stephen Moon of the Korea Institute Missions,
yes,
who said that Korean Christian missionaries are bold and adventurous, mm-hmm, but they lack cultural sensitivity.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes, Steve is one of my friends, and he's correct. And I also say that behind this religious fervor, you know, we have learned how to be involved in world mission from our Western brothers and sisters, which the strategy was born in the colonial time. So Korean church is repeating or continuing the Western strategy, Western approach. But their strategy doesn't seem to be working out now. We may have to approach in a very different way, radically different way, when we go into a very dangerous territory. But we haven't gone that far yet in our training, because we are now living in a very different world than the time when Western missionaries were working in their own time.
And yet, of course, the Western missionaries did great damage to many countries in the course of proselytizing for the Christian God. Do these missionaries see opportunities to help people in the war zones, and what are the opportunities they see?
That's what the Korean church learned from the Western brothers and sisters. What they remember about Western mission in Korea was their sacrifice. You know, the Catholic mission, for about 100 years, we had series of persecutions in Korea, and many Western brothers and sisters sacrificed their lives. And even the first Protestant missionary to Korea, he was beheaded as soon as he landed on the Korean soil. So Korean, in the minds of in the memory of Korean Christians, they feel that because of this blood shed upon the soil, the Korean church was able to explode. And so that's what they feel, kind of a divine burden, or that's the way they have to repay to the Western brothers and sisters by going out into the remote, unreached people groups. So that is behind kind of a driving force.
So in a sense, the patron saint who brings Christianity to Korea becomes the model for martyrdom elsewhere.
Kind of, yes. I believe so. And they also started with education mission and medical mission. The first missionaries, American missionaries to Korea, they were doctors and educators, and they did wonderful job in the Korean society, helping the poor people and sick people, and helping less privileged people being educated. So that transformed the Korean society, and that they find that is the model. So that's the way they are engaged in providing medical help and educational facility in less privileged societies in the global context.
Professor Moon Jang Lee, I understand that there is a connection between this Korean missioner and the campus that you're on now, Gordon Conwell Theological mm-hmm. Seminary. Can you tell us what it is?
Oh, yes. The Pastor Baer, who was killed in Afghanistan, his sister is with us. Her husband is a student at Gordon Conwell, and they are heading for Korea this afternoon to attend Pastor Baer's funeral.
Have you spoken to them and heard their...
Yes, I visited their family yesterday to pray with them and to console them. And they were in tears and they were in much sorrow.
Moon Jang Lee, Associate Professor of World Christianity at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary in South Hamilton, Massachusetts. My condolences are with you and the community, sir, and thanks for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
It's Here and Now. I'm David Boeri, sitting in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Can you name the world's seventh biggest emitter of carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas that's the major contributor to climate change? Britain? Japan? Maybe Germany? Well, those industrialized nations are all in the top 10, but occupying the number 7 spot is the northeast region of the United States, just the northeast, 10 states in all. While the federal government has yet to come up with a comprehensive national plan to reduce carbon dioxide, the northeast states have developed one of their own. It's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or RGGI, REGGI. And joining us is Michael Stoddard, an attorney and deputy director of Environment Northeast, one of 24 stakeholders in the REGGI process. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us why this regional approach came about.
It started back around 2001, 2002. The New England governors meet annually to talk about issues of mutual interest, and one of the things at the top of their list at that time was climate change. They set some medium and long-term targets, and they directed their staffs to come up with policy proposals to get to those targets.
And part of this was a reaction, I take it, to inaction on the federal level.
Well, that's exactly right. You'll notice the timing there coincides with the arrival of the current administration. And so, similarly, they noticed that there was not a lot of action at the federal level. Mm.
The REGGI plan is a plan to reduce CO2 emissions with a market-based cap-and-trade scheme. Explain how that works.
A cap-and-trade system is a regulation where you pick a group of polluters, in this case power plants, and you say, we're going to put a maximum limit on the total amount of CO2 that you're allowed to emit over the course of a year. And it then says to the power plants who are regulated, you folks decide what's the most cost-effective way to stay within that cap. And over time, starting in 2009 and then gradually phased in over to 2019, they need to gradually reduce the total cap to about 10% below current levels.
And they can buy credits if from others if, in fact, they don't meet it.
They can buy from each other. If one of them is particularly successful in reducing their emissions and has less need for the credits, that'll make it easier for someone else to buy them.
How many facilities are you talking about?
There are 230 power plants that are big enough to trigger coverage by this regulation.
Why just focus on power plants?
Well, they were the easiest place to start, and this is precedent-setting policy. It's not been done before in the United States, and so it makes sense to choose power plants because there aren't very many of them when you compare them to other polluters. They are large and sophisticated businesses, and they deal with this kind of regulation as they have in the past decade. They've all been quite successful in complying with the acid rain program, which uses a very similar kind of cap-and-trade system.
Some of the critics say that this does little more than give the biggest CO2 emitters permission to keep on emitting. So instead of making CO2 emitters upgrade emission control mechanisms or switch to wind or solar, cap-and-trade programs allow emitters to buy credits.
Well, there's going to be a price tag associated with those credits, and if they have to buy a lot of them, which the dirtiest plants will, that's going to become very expensive and gradually cause them to become uncompetitive. Meanwhile, the wind or the hydro or the solar or other cleaner generators will not have to pay that price, and they should either run more or build more of them, and that's how we will gradually transition our power fleet to a much cleaner power fleet.
Since Northeast states consume more energy than they generate and they have to import power from outside, isn't this system just going to generate more emissions outside the region?
Well, that could happen, and that's called leakage. That could happen if we did nothing to address it. But all of the participating states have made a commitment that they will address that so that we avoid leakage. And one of the ways we're looking at is encouraging other states or jurisdictions that surround these 10 Northeast states to join us.
This story of leakage does underline the importance of a national emission reduction strategy, doesn't it?
It would be preferred. We all are hoping that in the near future we will see a national program developed. But as everyone knows who follows the climate change issue, we can no longer afford to wait. So these states are getting ahead of the curve. The businesses and the consumers who live and work in these states are going to be the beneficiaries because we will actually be more competitive, less carbon dependent at the end of this program. So we'll be in much better shape to succeed when there is a federal program.
Michael Stoddard is an attorney and deputy director of Environment Northeast. Michael, thanks for your time today.
It was my pleasure.
Joining us now is Eric Svensson. He's vice president for environment, health, and safety at Public Service Electric and Gas, one of the Northeast's major energy suppliers. It's based in New Jersey. And Mr. Svensson, welcome.
Oh, how you doing there?
What's your company doing to get ready for the change that's coming in 2009 when you have to comply with a RGGI program?
To comply with a cap on a power plant, there's a number of ways one could do it. One could actually take the most efficient, lowest carbon-emitting plants in the portfolio and try to have them run more and have the ones that produce more CO2 run less. Another way would be is to say, okay, well, for every ton that's going out the stack, how can I find a way to comply with that cap? Could I buy allowances from somebody else, a generator that may have shut down or doesn't need as many allowances, or from a state that's going to be willing to sell the allowances? Or I can go out and meet a certain amount of my obligations through what they call offsets.
Now, that's interesting. How do offsets fit into the cap and trade? They're neither caps or trade, are they?
What it's been contemplated in the RGGI system is that they would allow a certain small percentage of compliance requirements to be met through using things such as landfill gas projects that would be, let's say, used to produce electric power. Well, using landfill gas is a renewable resource, and if I use renewable generation, I might be able to buy offsets from that zero emitting generation. Another thing might be in terms of a carbon sequestration project, where if I could get something verified that so many tree plantings or other things would actually absorb so much carbon dioxide and be worth so many CO2 tons, I could use that as a tradable allowance. But all this is subject to the approvals of regulators to say, yep, we agree that those are tradable credits to be utilized by the power industry.
Realistically, are these expenses going to be passed on to your consumers, businesses, and homeowners?
At the end of the day, the consumer is the one that pays for the electricity. It doesn't mean that, though, the consumer is going to pay all the total freight of what every individual power generator gets impacted from a cost. People that have generators that have less carbon intensity to their generation are not going to incur as much from a cost standpoint of production relative to their amount of CO2 emitted. Other power generators that rely heavily on coal-fired generation are likely to find their costs going up dramatically. The marketplace is a blend of all that type of generation, so there will be, amongst the generators, winners and losers.
Eric Svensson is Vice President for Environment, Health, and Safety at Public Service Electric and Gas. For more on the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Svensson.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, the week in sports, and what a week it's been here and now. Cats have been linked to supernatural activities since the ancient Egyptians venerated them as gods more than 4,000 years ago. But can an ordinary house cat predict imminent death? Today's New England Journal of Medicine has the story of Oscar the Cat, a 2-year-old gray and white feline at the Steer House Nursing and Rehabilitation Center in Providence, Rhode Island. When Oscar curls up with the patient, the staff knows that death is coming, usually within 4 hours. So far, Oscar has seemed to predict the passing of 25 patients, and that made Dr. David Dosa of Brown University think it was more than a coincidence. Dr. Dosa wrote an essay about Oscar for the New England Journal of Medicine and joins us on the line. Welcome, Dr. Dosa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, and you're famous today. Can you describe Oscar the cat for us? It looks like a cute little cat with some, you know, could be eating kibbles and bits.
Well, I can assure you that he does eat normally. He does eat his cat food and doesn't eat anything that's totally abnormal. He is a very cute cat, but not particularly friendly to staff members or even the residents on the floor. About a year and a half ago, he started spending a lot of time with family members and patients as they near death. I think we all started to notice that this was a phenomenon when the main hospice organization here in Rhode Island awarded him with a certificate. I guess it was partly in jest, but the staff members who work at the nursing home had noticed that he was spending a lot of time comforting patients as they were dying.
In your lovely essay, you describe Oscar making the rounds. I wonder if you could read part of that.
Certainly. Making his way back up the hallway, Oscar arrives at room 313. The door is open and he proceeds inside. Mrs. K is resting peacefully in her bed, her breathing steady but shallow. She is surrounded by photographs of her grandchildren and one from her wedding day. Despite these keepsakes, she is alone. Oscar jumps onto her bed and again sniffs the air. He pauses to consider the situation and then turns around twice before curling up beside Mrs. K.
And Mrs. K would go on to die.
That's correct.
And you even quote a child asking the mother why the cat was there. And the mother fights back tears, you write, and tells the child he's here to help Grandma get to heaven. Do the patients' families feel comforted by Oscar, or have some of them dreaded his presence?
Some have asked me if the patients understand, and unfortunately, this is an end-stage dementia unit where patients have often lost the ability to comprehend meaning behind certain things. In terms of family, we've had amazing family input with regards to this story, and with very rare exceptions, Oscar becomes a comfort to families.
But at the same token, Doctor, the people who are there to die, they're going to die. Isn't there a strong, strong probability that this is just a coincidence?
You know, it's occurred so many times now that we find it truly remarkable. Certainly patients are going to die, but oftentimes patients will spend a year, sometimes 2 years on this floor. Many of them are functionally impaired, but otherwise relatively healthy, other than their primary dementia illness.
Do you see anything in the literature that indicates, you were writing an essay, I understand, but that this has scientific basis?
You know, I've certainly heard over the course of the last few days many, many stories, and people have been very kind to forward me, you know, their stories, and some even scientists appear to be studying it. There is something here in terms of animals and a sixth sense, whether they're able to pick up on things sometimes before humans is well known in the literature.
Well established in the literature, both fictional and nonfiction. Of course, Jack London's To Build the Fire, one of the great short stories of American literature, ends with the dog holding up his nose, sniffing and deciding his owner is dead and turning and walking down the trail.
Certainly there's ample evidence of this in fiction and some in the scientific literature. It's really a phenomenon, I believe, that bears closer scientific scrutiny.
Dr. David Dosa, assistant professor at Brown University School of Medicine. To read his essay, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks for joining us, doctor.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, a look at the Tour de France and other sports news, here and now. I'm David Boeri. It's Here and Now. The sports arena is often portrayed as a refuge to be found from the cares of the world, but this week comes proof the world intrudes too often. Tragedy at a celebration of a soccer win in Baghdad, the arraignment of an NFL quarterback, suspicion and the expulsion of the race leader at the Tour de France. And that's just the beginning. Here to talk about all the news is Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Welcome on a rather sad day, Bill.
Thank you, David.
We have to begin in Baghdad. So there were huge celebrations all over Iraq when that country's soccer team beat South Korea to advance to the finals of the Asia Cup in a tight game finally decided on penalty kicks. So look at the face of those jubilant young boys, maybe 10 years old, clutching the flags of Iraq in the papers today, and then reflect on the two suicide car bombs that exploded in the middle of the celebration, killing at least 50 and injuring over 100.
Well, the violence in Iraq, of course, is an ongoing story, and as long as the U.S. has occupied Iraq or inefficiently occupied Iraq, this has been the case. I suppose, realistically, there's no reason to think that a soccer celebration should be immune any more than a bunch of young men lining up to serve and enlist in the police force should be immune from a bomb going off. On the other hand, it strikes me that it's really quite encouraging that the capacity of the human spirit to experience joy is unquenchable. And so even in this terrible circumstance in Iraq, these people go out into the street and wave their flags and celebrate the fact that their soccer team has won, a tiny achievement in the middle of a hideous ongoing tragedy. But how wonderful that people still feel the compulsion, the necessity to celebrate and to experience joy.
Which makes that picture all the more tragic.
Absolutely.
Looking at that. Today in a federal courtroom in Virginia, Atlantic Falcons quarterback Michael Vick is expected to enter a plea on conspiracy charges involving dog fighting, training dogs to fight, and killing dogs that lose at Vick's property. That operation, by the way, was called the Bad News Kennels.
N-E-W-Z. Standard boys in the hood spelling.
That's right. As sports reporters, you know, have gotten used to saying, these are only charges, nothing has been proven. Vick has said he knows nothing about the operation, and he's been barred from the training camp while the league investigates. Is Michael Vick already facing a possible end to his career?
Well, the commissioner of the National Football League, Roger Goodell, some time ago instituted a player conduct policy, and the theory was zero tolerance for misconduct, which is not only criminal but also harmful to the image of the league. In other words, it needn't be criminal. Somebody doesn't have to be convicted of a crime if what they're doing is perceived as detrimental to the image of the league. Mr. Goodell has said the image is very important. We don't want to lose fans. We don't want people feeling bad about the NFL. I would think that probably Michael Vick is in serious trouble, at least in the short term, with charges against him, the very possible suspension. He's already been told not to report to training camp. It's kind of hard to see how anything good comes of this.
And the idea of sports, of dogfighting being a sport, that is certainly a challenging notion, isn't it?
Oh, it's a preposterous notion. Dogfighting, cockfighting, they're not sports. They're you know, vicious exploitation and inhumane treatment of animals.
Bad news story number three, the Tour de France ends this coming Sunday, and does anyone care who wins at this point? Such is the suspicion, the taint of drug use.
I can't help it. I have an image of the Tour de France. Here's my image of the Tour de France. We tune in a couple of days, and there's one rider. And he's riding at a leisurely pace, and he's really making a tour of France. He's looking at the landscape, the green fields, the chattering birds, and he doesn't have to ride fast because there's no competition. All the other riders have either tested positive for something or they've been accused of running away from the drug testers, and all the teams have dropped out. And he's maybe wearing a derby, you know, and he doesn't have to wear those tight, silly cycling uniforms
he could be stopping for wine along the way. That could be his drug abuse.
A little cheese, a little bread at the side of the road. It's a lovely image, don't you think?
And this comes, of course, after the leader, Danish cyclist Michael Rasmussen, was dumped from the Tours because his team suspected he was evading the doping test. Is it all over for that sport?
Well, I don't know. Sometimes with college, university football programs, when they reach a point where they're just so besmirched and fouled by breaking rules and recruiting violations and everything else, they have something called the death penalty in college sports. And they say, look, this program is so far out of control, we're going to shut it down for a period of a couple of years, and we're going to give you a chance to kind of clean house and reestablish the program on a new basis. And maybe that's what has to happen with this race.
Isn't it remarkable that you can say the only good thing about this week is that it was a good week for Barry Bonds?
It was a great week for Barry Bonds. Nobody's paying any attention to him with all this other stuff going on.
Turning to professional basketball, let's listen to a little of a press conference earlier this week given by NBA Basketball Commissioner David Stern.
This is the most serious situation and worst situation that I have ever experienced, either as a fan of the NBA, a lawyer for the NBA, or a commissioner of the NBA.
Of course, the commissioner is referring to the resignation of referee Dan Danagy, for allegedly betting on games. Bill, how much could that ref have done to influence the outcome of games?
Well, he could have done a great deal. The ref in a basketball game has a tremendous amount of power. Call a couple of fouls on a player, that brings about the real possibility that the player will foul out. It alters that player's strategy. It may cause the coach to take the player out of the game because he doesn't want to have him get another foul. And so many basketball games are so close. It's very, very possible that a ref would have a tremendous impact on the outcome of a game. And then even if it isn't the outcome, an enormous impact on the point spread, which is, of course, what gamblers are really most interested in anyway.
And the question that everyone's asking is, could he be the only one? Here's the commissioner again.
Mr. Donaghy is the only referee who is alleged to have bet on NBA games and disclosed confidential information to others with respect to NBA games that would enable them to place wagers with an advantage.
So what do you make of this?
Well, the commissioner obviously has his fingers and his toes and probably his eyes crossed on this one, hoping that this is the one bad apple theory. But nobody knows. And once the FBI and various other people start investigating something like this, it's pretty much impossible to predict. Of course, the other thing is Mr. Donaghy is going to try to work the best deal he can for himself. And so who knows who is
Ooh,
now waiting for the names to begin coming out.
We can't leave the subject of the NBA without commenting on the commissioner's reference description that in fact, this is the worst situation I have ever experienced as a fan of the NBA, a lawyer, or a commissioner.
Right. Well, this, of course, is a public relations disaster. It's very bad for the league if people believe that the integrity of the officiating and of the game itself is not solid. But to suggest that this is the worst thing that has happened, it means that it's worse than players abusing their wives and girlfriends. It's worse than players going into the stands and getting into fights with fans. It's worse than a player choking his coach. I have a little bit of a problem with that kind of perspective myself.
Take us out on some positive news briefly. Cal Ripken.
Cal Ripken, 2,632 consecutive games, and almost everybody, 98.53%, voted yes, put him in the Hall of Fame. I don't know what those other 1.5% were thinking, but good on Cal.
NPR's Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, thanks a lot. Have a happier week than this.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Happier trails, everyone. I'm David Boeri. Join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.